It is just about 8:35 in the morning. You're listening to Upfront. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiekert.
And I am Kat Brooks. On Sunday, the U.S. women's soccer team saw their second consecutive World Cup win, this time against the Netherlands. In addition to the clapping and the cheering for the win, the crowd also exploded into this. The chance for equal pay follow a lawsuit that was filed in March by more than two dozen players against the United States Soccer Federation, citing discrimination in pay. Joining us to discuss is Brenda Elsey, an associate professor of history at Hofstra University. Her research focuses on the intersection of gender, politics, and sports, especially in Latin America. She's also a co-host on the feminist sports podcast, Burn It All Down. Oh, I love the name of that show. Good morning, Brenda, my kind of
Good
woman.
Good morning. Yeah, it's very apropos of the show itself.
Right on. Okay, so talk to us about, and I want to break that because there's a couple of layers to this gender pay gap. So let's start with the United States Soccer Federation. What is the pay gap and how is that related to actually how women soccer players and male soccer players actually get paid via their contracts?
So the details of the last agreement aren't available to us from 2017, but if you look at prize money and if you look at sort of the subsidies for each game, they're really different. So the men make considerably more. And this also goes to the coaches where, you know, the men's coach may make even $1.5 million in a severance pay. Jill Ellis is paid under $300,000. Mm. So the structure in general is men are making about double of what the women are making, despite the fact that the women's revenues were higher for the same amount of games, for much more successful performances. All around, the women are making more money for U.S. Soccer Federation and are being paid significantly less.
Now, there's also an issue with how FIFA, FIFA, pays out wins from the World Cup as well, right? So that's the international organization that oversees stuff, and they have some pay discrepancies also in terms of how much they shell out to teams depending on who wins, women or men.
Huge difference. So the men's World Cup prize money totals about $440 million, and the women's World Cup prize money is $30 million. It is doubling to $60 million. But yeah, it's a huge difference. So yes, they're going to say something like FIFA will say, look how much we've increased it. But proportionately, it's actually just as big of a gap as it's always been, a little bit more, in fact.
Now, the lawsuit that has been filed, though, is against the U.S. Soccer Federation. What are the allegations and what are the hoped for outcome?
Well, they agreed to tentative mediation after the World Cup. So the U.S. Women's National Team, I think, did something strategically, you know, absolutely smart in their interest, which was to say, hey, we could negotiate this before this major tournament where we're going to have a groundswell of support and goodwill, you know, or we could wait. And I think we're seeing the fruits of their efforts, and it's a really perfect time for them to go after U.S. Soccer Federation on this. I was really disappointed just the language of Carlos Cordero and U.S. Soccer Federation. They referred to the women just right before the World Cup as the plaintiffs. I mean, it's just like it's really ridiculous. It's sort of an open and shut case, and I think you can see from the crowds chanting today at the parade at Carlos Cordero, nobody thinks that this is fair, that they're making any less money. But they're asking for equal pay, but they're also asking for equal conditions. So travel conditions, field conditions, things like that, which are really important considerations.
That was actually something else I was going to ask you, was what other inequities in addition to pay are there in the investment between women and men's soccer teams by the federation?
Yeah, it comes down to that. I mean, travel conditions, field conditions, U.S. women not only, they actually had a lot of solidarity from other players like Marta from Brazil had been part of the lawsuit in 2015 Women's World Cup about using artificial turf. So those types of conditions that they want to be equal are going to be there. Also, there's going to be a question of like BAR, which was very controversial during this, but
what is
reviewed. the video assistant referee. So that's the system where the ref on the field has some obligation and capacity to have a video review of the play. And this was really controversial during this Women's World Cup because it had never been implemented in women's soccer before, only in men's. And so when the women got there, it really, for many of them, was a big disadvantage because there's different things like, you know, goalkeeper coming off her goal line just by like a teensy, teensy bit. And that's something that with the naked eye, one doesn't see, but then gets reviewed. And that probably hurt some of the less professional teams, the ones where they had received less instruction on it. And those are mostly from the Global South. So that was pretty disappointing, you know, for many of us to see them go out often with that kind of technology being used.
Are folks hopeful around mediation, or do you think this is going to have to go into a full-fledged court case?
I'm very hopeful about mediation. I think just watching the parade today and the response of people, and then there's also been, you know, a couple politicians who have mentioned taking this up and trying to say, well, we'll suspend the money because U.S. Soccer Federation does get, you know, government investment as well. So there's different politicians that have started to take this up and looked at what that relationship is like. And so I think it's very much in the interest of the U.S. Soccer Federation to settle and in with all the terms.
Aside from, you know, like patriarchy and sexism, what's the origin of the pay gap? Is it that it's only a recent phenomenon that the women's teams bring in so much money?
It's just what you said. It's patriarchy and sexism. It's always been like that. It's always been like that. You know, and the women's team has always done very well. This isn't a new thing. It's been for many, many years that the women's team has been very successful. What's interesting about this is it really shatters the argument that it's not about sexism, that it's about the market. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times, you know, in all kinds of jobs or sports or whatever, the argument of institutions like this is, well, women's sports just aren't as marketable. They're not as profitable. And that's how they justify giving them poor treatment. First of all, you know, government investment in men's sports has been enormous, tremendous, all over the world. So the idea that a free market exists anyway is a fallacy. Mm-hmm. But now we even have a case with the U.S. women where not only is that fallacy, you know, still at work, but this other one, which is that they're actually making more money and they're still refusing to pay them. Mm-hmm. So it's just deep-seated patriarchy and sexism and the idea that the men's team is somehow doing more important work. And it's exactly the same game. It's just there's just no way to wrap it up.
Can you kind of walk us through the ownership and management structure? Like, whose decisions are these?
Well, there's not the U.S. Soccer Federation is its own, you know, sort of civic association. It's not owned by anyone. It does partially own the Women's Professional League, the NWSL. So it's a part owner of that league. And that's a pretty complicated financial agreement that I don't even fully understand. But yeah, it's sort of like thinking about the U.S. Olympic Committee. Right. It's a standalone civic association. So the structure is that it gets money from FIFA. It can get money from CONCACAF, which is the Confederation of Football. So you have the big overarching monster that is FIFA. And I don't say that lightly. And then underneath it are confederations, which are like the African Confederation, European. And then you've got North America and South America. So CONCACAF is another layer there. And then underneath that is U.S. Soccer Federation. U.S. Soccer Federation can decide how to pay out FIFA development money. FIFA doesn't say, you know, you can't give as much to women of this development money. So it really is on U.S. Soccer Federation. They're the ones that get the tickets, the gate receipts. They're the ones that get the kickback from the jerseys. It's within their power to pay them equally.
But what FIFA does control is how much they pay, the difference in the payout for wins between men and women. And so even if the lawsuit is won, you know, against the U.S. Soccer Federation, then what is the next step of the organizing plan, or what leverage is there to get FIFA to more equitably pay women's teams for their wins as they do men's?
Well, in terms of the prize money, it's once every 4 years. So I think it's a really good thing to start first at the federation level, because that's where more players are affected by that more often, right? And then to take it to FIFA. And taking it to FIFA is incredibly frustrating and difficult, because they keep sort of making these promises. Gianni Infantino, the president of FIFA, came out last week and said there was going to be all this much more money, and they're going to expand the teams from 24 to 32. And that would obviously increase revenue as well, because there's more games and more tickets. So that's part of that scheme. The central problem here, though, is that there's absolutely no transparency and accountability within FIFA. Mm-hmm. I mean, you saw that with the lawsuits. That's ongoing. There has not been major changes to the accountability there. And so it's hard to hold them to task and say, this is what you have and this is what you make, because that's all shrouded in FIFA talk. And on top of that, there's really not much representation for women within the executive councils of FIFA. Mm-hmm. And that is a really sore point. So, you know, and they can't be sued. You know, it's not like you can sue them in the same way that you can take on the U.S. Soccer Federation. Right. Because this is prize money. It's not salary. It's not compensation, technically.
Right. We are speaking to Brenda Elsie, an associate professor of history at Hofstra University, whose research focuses on the intersection of gender, politics, and sports. I want to shift gears a little bit, because I think that there's another piece of this conversation that's really important. And so, yes, we're talking about the gender pay gap at the professional level. But can you talk about just across the board, right? There is gross disparities in investment in sports for girls and boys and men and women at all levels in this country.
Well, there is. I mean, Title IX has been amazing, but it's so often not implemented. It's so often under threat. That said, the conditions in terms of girls' sports here are shockingly almost better. I mean, are astonishingly better than they are in most of the countries that are competing in the Women's World Cup. And you see that. You see that payoff. And it's not to obfuscate the ongoing inequality here in the United States, but is to say, you know, it's really an accomplishment of Title IX that they're able to dominate the way that they are, and that many of the players that really shone from the Global South from, you know, in the Women's World Cup, actually participated in university athletics in the U.S. Mm. And they come to the U.S. and that's so, like, the goalkeeper for Jamaica, Nicole McClure, was at University of South Florida. So was the second goalkeeper for Argentina, Gabby Garton. So it's really fascinating to see the ways in which even university facilities here in the U.S. are better than any professional facility in Latin America.
And can you talk some, too, about the so there's all sorts of conversation about things that are good for kids in terms of what helps them stay in school or live healthier lives. Can you talk about the intersection of sports specifically for girls and life and academic outcomes?
So there's just tons of research across the board about how positive sports are in girls' lives in terms of self-esteem, in terms of their relationship with other girls, health, obviously. You know, underage pregnancies are way down, obesity, anything you can think of, almost depression. It's good for depression and mental health. It's good for academics, good for staying in school. I mean, there's really no downside to girls playing sports. And it's in all the research. The United Nations took it up 25 years ago. So we're really aware of how positive it is. And I would argue, too, and this isn't to criticize, you know, sports that are somewhat more individual, but there's something really fantastic. When I was doing, you know, the last couple books on women in soccer, and I interviewed so many women, and a central part of their experience was doing something with other young women that was not focused around boys, heteronormative things, makeup, shopping, you know, a non-consumerist sort of experience that they had with other girls. Mm-hmm. And that was just profound for them.
Are male soccer players stepping up as allies? Are there any notable examples of
I'm sorry to laugh. It's like you laugh or cry, right? Very, very few. Very few. And it's pretty frustrating. For example, you know, in Brazil, where you would think the male allyship, I mean, just because of the platform that those men have, it's so much bigger. It's sort of like, you know, taking the three big sports in the U.S. and those stars like LeBron James, Tom Brady, and I don't even know who, and you rolled them into one person and you would get Neymar's platform, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's been really frustrating because very few of them have spoken out. I guess the one difference this time was the Argentine men's team. Lionel Messi and Sergio Aguero and some others did really pretty big social media posts about the women and that they were participating in this. And that was really cool. And it was very validating for the women themselves because often, you know, they're being subsidized by their families in Argentina. There's nowhere a woman can play professional soccer and live well and live, you know, living wage in Argentina. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that their families have often put up with a lot, it really validated their experience, you know, to send their mom pictures with Leo Messi, right? Like he thinks I'm a great player and it shouldn't have to be that way. That's sad. But it made a huge difference, not only in the kind of platform they got in the Argentine press, but also their personal lives. I don't know that in the U.S. it would work quite the same way because, I mean, I do know Michael Bradley has said some supportive things, but I don't think the U.S. women's team needs the men's team's allyship. Mm. They did say that they several of them that they supported the equal pay clause. And it's interesting in Norway last year, the way that they got equal pay was that the men took voluntarily a pay cut and said, you know, we think this is wrong. We're going to take a pay cut. And that I think it was only like a 10% difference between them. And that really pushed the Norwegian Federation for equal pay. The same thing happened in Denmark. So male allyship can be very, you know, important. Of course, you want to make sure, like, that they don't take up all the space.
Right.
But yes, it could be, like, really valid. I just don't know. It's very different in the U.S. because soccer is just not the main sport, right?
Right.
And I don't know for how many people in the U.S., I think very few, recognize more men's players than women's players when it comes to soccer.
Yeah, sounds like maybe it'd be more important to have allyship from LeBron James.
I do think that could be true. Certainly David Beckham showing up for England, you know, meant a lot to them and bringing his daughters and whatnot. So, yeah, I mean, maybe LeBron should get on the women's soccer train right now. Come on.
We'll make some phone calls when we get off the air.
Brian knows him personally.
Oh, good. Perfect. Tell him.
Brenda, Elsie, thank you so much for joining us this morning, and I'll be tuning into that podcast.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Brenda Elsie is an associate professor of history at Hofstra University. Her research focuses on the intersection of gender, politics, and sports, especially in Latin America. She's also the co-host of what is now my new favorite name of a podcast, at least, Burn It All Down. Yes.
She really, you are the target market.
I mean, right? She wrote that for me.
That takes us to 8:54 in the morning. The program's Up Front. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiger.
I'm still Kat Brooks.
And we're going to take a quick look at what's happening on the stage. Here's Richard Walensky with a review of Stephen Sondheim's Passion, currently at the Custom Made Theater through Tuesday, July 20th.